It is blacker than a crow's wing, blacker than night. It is where they once threw the bodies of the vanquished queens, and where he threw his cat when he thought the priestesses were going to behead her. Peter tosses the mare's reins across a low branch. The long, knotted rope in his saddlebag was purchased from a trusted merchant in Prynne. Coil after coil of thick, sturdy knots that weighed the mare down on one side as they rode. Coil after coil, and still he is not sure whether he purchased enough. He studies the trees, but none seem strong enough to tie off on, not even the ones as thick as his waist, when the Breccia Domain is leering over his shoulder. He would prefer a trunk as thick as his horse. He considers rigging an additional safety line to her saddle, but if she were to run, she would drag him back up over the side. And besides, the extra line would cost too much rope. "Get on with it," he growls loudly to break the silence and bolster his courage. "I did not ride all this way for nothing." He holds his mare's cheeks between his hands. "If I am lucky," he says to her, "I will see what Cat saw." The horse blinks. It does not take a naturalist to see she knows he is lying. If Peter is lucky, he will not see or feel anything at all. He chooses a tree and ties his rope, then lets out slack all the way to the mouth of the fissure. Sweat dots his forehead. His hands shake. He is terrified of a hole in the ground. How Nicholas Martel would laugh at him if he were there. Peter throws the loose end of the rope over the side of the rocks, and it unfurls for many long seconds. He does not hear it strike the bottom. It only comes to an end, tugging against his fists. Perhaps the rumors are true, and there is no bottom. With the rope in place, he walks back to his horse and takes a small lamp out of his saddlebag. He ties it to his belt and stuffs extra matches into every pocket. Then he breathes in deep, goes to the edge, and lowers himself over the side. The knotted rope makes for easy enough going. His feet do not slip, and his hands are strong and sure. Even so, he keeps his eyes on the patch of blue and white sky overhead. When the patch is dishearteningly small and his legs have begun to tire, he finally looks around, resting against the side of the crevasse. The sides are sheer, steep rock. He does not know how Catherine was able to stop her fall. He continues on, deeper and deeper into the dark, until his feet search for the next knot, and it is not there. Peter's hands clench tight as he tries to catch his previous foothold. It is hard not to panic, thinking of how far it is to climb back up, and how far he may yet have to fall. And it is so dark now that he cannot see the rope in front of his face. A sudden wind moves across his shoulders. He jerks, and his hip strikes painfully against the stone. But it is only wind, sneaking down from the surface. Never mind that the wind somehow smells like death and rot, or that when he laughs at his foolishness, there is no echo. "There is nothing here," he thinks as the back of his neck prickles. "There is no one down here, no one watching. This was a waste." He reaches for the lantern at his belt. He will light it, just to be sure, to get a look at the darkness and nothing below his feet. But when his fingers find a match, he does not want to strike it. What if he is near the bottom? Will he see everything that they have discarded? Long dead queens lying in piles of bones and ragged black dresses, staring up at him with empty, accusing eye sockets and bare, yawning jaws. Or will he see Catherine, his Catherine, rotting where he threw her, and the claw marks on the stones of whatever scratched its way out to take her place? No, he thinks, that is foolishness, a flight of frightened fancy. He strikes the match. It struggles to light, and he touches it quickly to the lamp. Yellow-orange flame casts against his clothes, against his rope, and the stone it hangs beside. Carefully, he unties the lantern and holds it out, looking down past his feet. There is nothing. No bones of dead queens, no cavern bottom of rocky growths. It is only a void, and that is a wonder in itself, considering how far he has descended. The length of rope he would need to reach the bottom would have been too much for his horse to carry. All he can do now is drop the lamp and try to see something in the moment that it lands. Before he can let go, something scrapes against the rock. The sound was not subtle. It sounded close, but he cannot see a thing. I imagined it, he thinks, and then a lizard, or a natural shifting of the ground. Foul-smelling wind ruffles his hair. It curls into his collar like a bundle of clammy fingers. Who is there? A silly question, and no one replies. But in Peter's mind, he sees teeth and a grin stretched wide in the dark. He swings his lamp out to all sides. There are more noises now, scraping and the clacking of bones. It is not possible, he shouts, forgoing all restraint. There is nothing here. But everyone knows that the Breccia domain is more than an empty hole in the earth. Who knows what happened to the queens who were thrown down into the dark, into the heart of the island, where the goddess's eye is always open? Who knows how she kept those queens, or what she turned them into? Peter tries to steady his rapid breath. What did you do to her? What did you do to my Katarine? At the mention of her name, the air warms. Katarine was one of them. One of the fallen. There are centuries of sisters here, ready to listen to her woes and cradle her with skeletal hands. But that was a lie. Whatever help they gave was not for her. It was for them, and they have twisted through Katarine like ivy. Who are you? He shouts, but he already knows. And so the queens who dwell in the Breccia do not bother to tell him. What remains of them is uglier than bones and gray, withered skin. It is crushed hopes. The air reeks of their bitterness. Peter scrambles back up the rope. He has to get back to Katarine. It is my fault, he says, and drops the lamp to use both hands to climb. As the light flashes through the dark, it flashes past an upturned face. It is just for an instant. But it makes him scream, and the image of its empty eyes lingers in the dark. Peter climbs as fast as he can. It is not until he feels the bones brush against his ankle that he realizes that Katarine is a queen, and though she was able to survive the Breccia, he, in fact, may not. Indrid Down. The great round arena of Indrid Down sits on the outskirts of the city, at the center of a large open field, easy to be spotted in. But it was simple enough for Jules and Arsinoe to sneak into it and meet Kara and Madrigal after dark, creeping along the southern side, full of scaffolds and building materials. "Do you think anyone saw us?" Arsinoe wonders, out of breath. "Shush," says Jules, and stares out into the night for any sign of movement. "Don't be so worried," says Madrigal, and both Jules and Arsinoe jump. The guards are few and posted up high, or patrolling below in the staging rooms. "Come," she says. "I'll take you to Kara." They pass beneath the scaffolding, and Arsinoe stares up in wonder. The arena is enormous, a grand spectacle, even though several sections have fallen into disrepair. Part of the northern wall has crumbled away entirely, and the age of the structure is visible in cracks and weather-worn edges. "Where's Aunt Kara?" Jules asks. "Below the extra seating, near one of the entrances to the competition ground. It will be a good place." Jules senses something and stops short, causing Arsinoe to run into her back, just as Camden collides with their fronts, purring and butting her head into their faces. "Blah!" Arsinoe says, plucking fur from her mouth. I thought she was stashed at the stable.
Try telling her that, Kara says.
She stands leaning against a beam, arms crossed loosely.
Better to sneak her in under cover of dark, anyway. Tomorrow we'd have had to bring her in a cart, hide her under a pile of something.
Arsinoe looks over their hiding place and grasps one of the supports beneath the hastily repaired section overhead.
Why here? She asks.
The visibility would be better from the western side.
That is exactly why here, Jules says. No one will want to sneak in and watch from underneath the worst seats in the house.
Arsinoe pushes against the beam. Tomorrow, the arena will fill to capacity. People will pack in on top of one another.
I hope they don't fall through.
I hope Jules can do what she says. Madrigal looks out at the arena ground and sighs.
We never should have bound you. If you'd had all these years to develop your skill, this would be easy.
Arsinoe says nothing, but she sees the way Kara purses her lips. The binding on the Legion curse may have been the only thing that kept Jules sane. It may be the only thing keeping her sane now.
If you don't think you can, says Arsinoe, or if you don't want to, we can find another way.
No, says Jules. I can do it. I can guide Katarine's poisoned weapons off course long enough for Mirabella to kill her. This was my idea, the way least likely to get you caught. We can't change plans now.
Arsinoe's stomach flutters with nerves. There is no time to change plans anyway. The night is late. So late it is nearly dawn.
Jules has not used her war gift much, but it has been there when it mattered most.
And besides, Mirabella is so strong. The duel will be over with one lightning bolt.
The Highburn Hotel. Mirabella eases out of her ball gown and shivers.
Is there a chill? She asks.
Here, Mira. Elizabeth drags the coverlet from the bed and uses her good arm to wrap Mirabella up tight.
Is that better?
Yes, but in truth, the blanket feels like it came from a snowbank rather than a down-stuffed bed. And it hurts, like pinpricks against her skin. She takes a breath, and that hurts too.
You are so pale.
Elizabeth presses her hand to Mirabella's cheeks, and Mirabella gasps. A freshly tattooed black bracelet encircles Elizabeth's wrist. Bree sees it as well, and takes hold of Elizabeth's arms. They have even tattooed her left, just above the end of the stump. She has taken the oaths and become a full priestess.
You were supposed to tell us, Bree says. We would have been there.
Where is Pepper? Mirabella searches Elizabeth's hood and her long, dark hair. She had not realized how long it had been since she had seen the plucky woodpecker. She had just assumed he was staying in the trees outside the hotel.
He's gone, Elizabeth whispers. Ro made me choose. She had him in her fist.
A tear slides down her cheek.
I guess she knew about him all along.
Mirabella trembles, partly from rage, and the anger quickens her for a moment and makes it easier to breathe.
I could have stopped her, she says. I will still stop her.
No, Elizabeth wipes her face with the back of her sleeve. I would have chosen this, anyway, to be a priestess.
Sarah and Luca enter the room, Sarah with a tray of tea. She sets it on a small circular table.
You must be shaken to the core after that dance, Sarah says and pours a steaming cup. What a spectacle! Queen Katarine has nerve to spare.
Yes, says Luca. I am sure that Natalia never imagined she and I would need to separate the two of you like children fighting over toys.
It was not a fight, says Mirabella. It was not anything.
She is only trying to scare you, Bree curls her lip, as if she could.
But Katarine did scare her. And judging by their taut, pale faces, she had scared them all. Mirabella blinks. The room is spinning and blacking in and out. Sarah hands her a cup of tea.
I must sit, she murmurs.
The teacup falls and shatters at her feet, and she crumples to the floor.
Mira!
Elizabeth shouts. Sarah draws back, her hands to her face.
It is poison, she gasps.
Where is the taster? Where is he?
It was not his fault, Mirabella whispers.
Luca kneels at her side and barks for Ro. It takes less than a minute for the war-gifted priestess to secure the room, shuttering windows and ordering guards.
How? Ro asks. It must have been Katerine, Luca says. She must have had something on her gloves.
Luca holds Mirabella's hand and studies her skin everywhere that Katerine touched her during their dance. There is no redness or blisters, no sign of irritation.
Where is Billy?
He stayed behind, Bree says, with Joseph Sandrin.
He should have been watching her,
Sarah grinds her teeth.
Protecting her! So should we all, Luca says. But it does not matter now.
I have sent for healers, Ro calls from the door.
There is no pain, Mirabella says. I am only weak.
Perhaps it is not...
Her voice trails off.
Perhaps it is not poison at all.
Sarah touches her cheek. Bree and Elizabeth are both crying. She wishes she could tell them to stop, that she is fine. When the healers arrive, they lift her into bed. They take blood from her arm and sniff her breath. They poke and prod and pull back her eyelids to see how her eyes move.
She is getting no worse, they murmur after a time. Whatever it is not progressing.
Why would they poison her if not to kill her? Bree asks.
Because they have killed her, Luca says softly.
Sarah kneels beside the bed and takes Mirabella's hand. The poison does not race through her body. She does not break out in spasms or labor to breathe.
Cowards, Ro growls from the door,
and Mirabella hears something break as the war priestess loses her temper.
Can the duel be postponed? Sarah asks.
Luca shakes her head.
There is no rule against this. A poisoner is allowed to poison as they will, as they can.
No matter how Mirabella survives the night, she will still be too weak to fight in the morning.
She will walk into the arena as good as giftless. This was my fault, child, Luca says sadly. I let down my guard.
The arena. The arena grounds fill quickly. The vendors come first, right before dawn, to prepare food to sell from their stands. Skewers of chicken and plums, sweet roasted nuts, barrels of cooled wine and cider. Many foods Arsinoe had not tried. Her stomach rumbles. She sent Madrigal out as soon as the crowds were heavy enough to hide her, with plenty of coin to procure samples of everything. But she is not back yet.
So many people, Arsinoe muses, as the makeshift stands creak over their heads.
Dressed in their best, hair pinned and faces painted, to watch a queen die.
Don't think of that, Jules says, lurking in shadow with Camden. It must be done. And when it's over, the island will have a new elemental queen, and we'll be free to go.
I should go alone, says Arsinoe.
You shouldn't have to give up everything, too.
What am I giving up? Jules asks.
A town that will hunt me for my war gift?
There's no peace for me either,
now that my curse is known. Not everyone would be that way. Not Kate or Ellis. What about Madrigal and your new baby sister or brother?
Jules lowers her eyes and Arsinoe holds her breath. She does not know what she will do if Jules goes back to Wolf Spring. She does not know how to be without her.
I've never had any path but yours, Jules says. So I'll stay with you until the end.
She smiles impishly.
Or in until the curse drives me mad. At the sound of approaching footsteps, they tuck back into the shadows, and Arsinoe pulls the hood of her light cloak down over her eyes. But it is only Madrigal, and Kara, and Joseph as well, found wandering out on the arena grounds. Madrigal hands Arsinoe several skewers of different meats. "Don't share," she warns her as Arsinoe takes first bites. "Some are poisoned." "Were you followed?" Jules asks Joseph.
"No," he replies. "I meant to come last night, but by the time I realized you had left the ball, it was so late that I slept in the stables. Then I snuck in with the morning crowds."
He looks out at the throngs of people.
"Honestly, we needn't have bothered sneaking. Only one thing's on people's minds today, and it is not us."
Kara ducks below the beams and peers out into the stands. "There are so many poisoners," she says. "So many elementals."
"Almost no naturalists," Madrigal adds. "Not that I would have expected them to make the journey."
"Jules," Kara says. "Look there." She points. On the western side of the arena sits a serious-faced group wearing cloaks lined with bright red wool. They are so still that they stand out, calm in the midst of chaos.
"Who are they?" Jules asks.
"I think they are warriors. From Bastion City."
"Are there oracles too?" Arsinoe asks. "Can they tell us what's going to happen and relieve us of the suspense?"
The corner of Kara's mouth twists upward. She turns to Madrigal and says, "We should go. Back to the Volroy to be ready to free the bear. We'll guide him out to the riverbank while the city is mostly empty."
Madrigal frowns. It is clear she would rather stay and watch the action. But eventually she nods and goes without complaint.
"Do you think they'll manage to do it without killing each other first?" Arsinoe wonders aloud. And Joseph comes to stand between her and Jules. He slips an arm about the shoulders of each of them.
"Where will we go?" he asks. "After this?"
"Sunpool, maybe," says Jules. "I've always wanted to see it, and with so many oracles, they'll already know we're coming."
"Not the ending we hoped for," says Joseph, "but far better than the ending we feared. The only thing missing will be Billy."
Arsinoe tries to smile, to enjoy the daydream of the three of them together at last. But a daydream is all it is. In Sunpool or anywhere else, they will be hunted. Their lives will be in disguise and in secret, on the move and on the run. And what kind of a life is that?
Better than no life at all, Jules would say. But Arsinoe is not so sure.
A rumble passes overhead when the gallery begins to fill with the duel's most illustrious guests, council members and errands.
"It won't be long now, Jules," Arsinoe says. "Are you ready?"
Jules cracks her knuckles.
"As I'll ever be."
Catarine tightens her leather arm guard. Her bow has been restrung, and her quiver filled with poisoned arrows made with fancy black and white feathers. At her belt, her slim, sharp throwing knives have been edged with enough curare to fell a horse. She also has a short-bladed sword. Though she does not intend to get close enough to use it, it would make for a fine and showy finishing strike.
"Will you take the crossbow?" Natalia asks, as she buttons Catarine's black silk vest and smooths the sleeves of her shirt.
"No, I have already used it on Arsinoe. Each of my sisters deserves her own special send-off."
Natalia holds up Catarine's tall, light boots. Her skirt of soft black leather will just touch the tops of them, and her maid Giselle has braided her hair into a knotted bun. There will be no long tresses to pull, nothing to get into her eyes.
"You seem so calm, Natalia," Catarine notes. "So confident."
"I am always calm and confident."
Natalia kneels to lace the boots. When she starts to hum, Catarine narrows her eyes. Before the ball, Natalia had been terrified,
snapping at the guards and asking where Peter was 100 times. Such a change between the ball and today. A servant enters carrying a tray of edible poisons, belladonna berries, and a savory tart of jack-o'-lantern mushrooms. Fresh milk, laced with more of Nicholas's white snake root. Katerine, Natalia cautions, is that wise? I would not go into a duel hungry. Then let me send for something else. Katerine cuts a large slice of tart and swallows half of the milk. The pain is nothing, Katerine assures her, wiping her chin. I have endured much worse. She pops a berry into her mouth as her stomach starts to churn and looks at her reflection in the mirror. She is no little girl who would turn into Natalia's skirts and weep. She is no weak queen to be thrown down the Breccia domain. She is outfitted for battle. And after today, she will be the next queen crowned. Mirabella recovers from the poison faster than anyone dared to hope, and the priestesses pray thanks to the goddess. But it is still not fast enough. When she holds her hand out to a candle, she can light it, but she cannot make it flare. Water is a waste of time. She has not dared to test her lightning, and Luca says that she should not, that it would give the errands too much satisfaction to see only a rain shower form above the arena. I feel like I failed you, Billy says, standing behind her. Now I have failed you both. You did not fail anyone. Not me. Certainly not Arsinoe. The sadness in her loved one's eyes is hard for Mirabella to take. Not one imagined that she could lose the duel before it even started. Sooner or later, Billy, the poison always finds its target. This was not your fault. The priestess fastening her light dress of black wool begins to weep. Ro cuffs her on the back of the head and steps forward to finish what she started, tugging Mirabella's bodice tight. Avoid her, the red-haired priestess whispers. Use your shield and avoid her as long as you can. Save your gift for one good shot. The Queen's Duel. When the duel begins, everyone in attendance is on their feet, screaming, regardless of their affiliation. None of them have ever seen a duel. The air is abuzz with excitement, even stronger than the scent of cinnamon-spiced sweets and roasted meat on sticks. Mirabella walks to the center of the arena. Wind blows her hair off her shoulders, and she pretends that it is her wind, even as fear drenches her heart like cold water. Before the ball, her greatest fear was that her will would fail when she looked into Katerine's eyes. How foolish she had been! She nods to the Westwoods and to Luca in the gallery. She would raise her arm, but the shining silver shield feels like it weighs more than she does. When I was a child, I asked to play here, Katerine says, as she and Natalia stand at the entrance to the competition ground. But you would never let me. Do you remember?
I remember, Natalia replies. But this is no game, Kat.
Katerine taps the throwing knives at her belt and feels the sway of the sword strapped to her back. The crowd roars for Mirabella as she makes her entrance. But that is all right. It is the last time that anyone will ever cheer for her. Poor Mirabella. Katerine says, so brash and impulsive, coming to my city to challenge me. After it is over, they will call her a fool. But that will not be fair. Mirabella did not know who Katerine really was. How could she? Not even Natalia knows that, and Katerine always thought that Natalia knew everything. Go and sit in the gallery, Katerine says. I would walk in alone. Natalia's mouth tightens, so Katerine softens her voice. I do not want you to miss it. Natalia touches Katerine's hair. Her eyes move over every inch. Her face, her hands, the laces of her boots,
as if she is trying to commit them to memory. Katarine almost shrugs her off. She wants to begin. She wants the crowd to roar for her. Natalia leaves, and Katarine waits until she sees her ice-blonde head in the gallery, before walking out with her arms raised. The crowd screams. From the oldest woman in the stands to the children watching from window seats in nearby buildings, they all scream. Only the priestesses remain still and silent. But of course they would. They are priestesses. The noise fills Katarine with pleasure, but it does not compare to the feeling she gets when she looks at Mirabella. Her pretty, regal sister is glaring at her. Yet underneath the glare is fear so thick that Katarine can almost smell it. "That is a very fine shield," she calls out, and the crowd quiets. "You are going to need it." Across the arena, Mirabella cringes as Katarine unslings her bow and knocks an arrow. She fires it and rolls to dodge any counter of lightning. But none comes. There is only the crowd's moan when her arrow bounces off the shield. She knocks another and lets it fly, and Mirabella dives clumsily to the ground. Katarine dodges again, anticipating a counterattack. But again, there is nothing. Something is not right. "What is this, sister?" she shouts. "Is the great elemental afraid to fight?" Mirabella peeks out from behind her shield. "That would be a strange thing indeed," she shouts back, though her voice is high and weak, "when it was I who issued the challenge." Suspicious, Katarine advances until she is close enough to see the sweat dotting Mirabella's forehead, and to note the rapid rise and fall of her ribcage, too labored for so early in the fight. Her eyes are the eyes of a cornered dog, and it is plain to see that she has been poisoned. Katarine turns toward the gallery, where Natalia watches confidently beside the rest of the Black Council. "So this is why you were not worried." It does not matter what she has done in a month since Beltane. To Natalia, she will always be a failure. Katarine drops her bow and quiver of arrows into the freshly tilled dirt. She pulls a throwing knife from her belt and takes careful aim. Mirabella cannot cover every inch of herself with that shield. With her sister crouched and poison slowed, it will not be the glorious victory Katarine planned, but the end result will be the same. She throws the knife. It is not until her blade curves unexpectedly to the right that Katarine suspects the fight may yet be interesting. Mirabella dodges another knife. The boards creak, and dirt settles onto Arsinoe's head as the crowd above twists in their seats to get a better view. "Was that you?" Arsinoe asks Jules. "Or a bad throw?" "I don't know," Jules replies irritably. "I haven't done much of this." In the arena, Mirabella rolls and nearly loses her hold on the shield.
"What is the matter with her?"
Joseph asks, from over Arsinoe's shoulder.
"Why doesn't she strike?"
"I don't know," Arsinoe says. "But something is wrong." The crowd senses it too, murmuring in confusion every time Mirabella dodges an attack and does not counter.
"Why won't she do anything?" Jules growls, using her war gift to push another of Katarine's knives wide.
Her cheeks are red from exertion, and her brown hair damp at the roots.
"This won't work if she refuses to kill. Legion cursed or not, I can't spark fire."
"Good goddess," Arsinoe whispers, as Katarine goes back to her bow. She shoots an arrow and pinions Mirabella's trailing skirt to the boards of the arena wall. Mirabella has been poisoned. Mirabella felt the feather of the poisoned arrow graze her leg when it passed. That is how close it came to being over. The sound of it sinking deep into the wood chilled her to the bone. She thought it was the sound of it burying itself in her thigh.
She drops her shield to yank at her skirt, trying to rip it loose. But it is stuck, fast. The material is too thick to tear through. Mirabella panics. She cries out and calls the wind to send Katarine flying halfway across the arena. But nothing more comes than a strong gust. It wobbles Katarine and sends her sideways onto her knee, but it does not even knock her over. Katarine laughs and draws the sword from the hilt on her back. "This was not the way it was meant to be," Mirabella says.
"Poor sister," says Katarine. "You have heard those priestesses say you were chosen so many times that you actually came to believe it."
"Luca!" Mirabella screams.
"Bree! Elizabeth!"
She stops and takes deep, frightened breaths. "Turn away! Turn away and do not watch!" Overhead, the summer sky is cloudless and free of storms. The last she will see as her sister raises the sword. How strange, how humiliating, that this is how the poisoner will kill her, in a way where the poison on the blade does not even matter.
"Katarine! Get away from her!"
Mirabella flinches as Katarine is jerked backward, tossed toppling into the dirt. The shout came from the side of the arena opposite, and Mirabella cannot believe her eyes. It is Arsinoe. Arsinoe and Jeuien Malone. When Arsinoe saw the sword ready to swing down and sever Mirabella's head, she did not think. She just bolted into the arena and Jules followed. Jules followed, like always, and used her war gift to send Katarine flying. The crowd screams at the sight of Arsinoe returned from the dead, and she realizes what she has done. Katarine rolls up onto her knee, her lips pulled back in a grimace of disbelief.
"You!"
she yells, and points at the two of them.
"You again!"
"Yes, me again," Jules growls. She steps in front of Arsinoe. Joseph and Camden run to Mirabella. And then the crowd finds its voice.
"That is the naturalist. It cannot be. She is dead."
Arsinoe shifts her weight. There is no mistaking her unmasked before the city. They see her scars slashed across her cheek.
"You are dead," Katarine shrieks. "I killed you!"
"You should have checked," Arsinoe yells back. "The poisoned bolt never pierced my leather armor."
The stands rumble with shocked whispers.
"I saw the blood!"
Katarine screeches and braces when Jules clenches her fists.
"You saw what we wanted you to see."
"Arsinoe?" Mirabella asks.
"Arsinoe, you are alive?"
Arsinoe keeps one eye on Katarine as she walks to her sister. She stretches her hand out, and Mirabella's fingers wrap around it.
"But I saw you fall in the forest."
"I'm a good actress, born for the stage."
The lie is a gamble. All Katarine need do is ask her to show her back, or even to raise her right arm quickly, and her poisoner secret will be out. But Katarine has not dared to make a move, and she will not for as long as Jules is there.
"Let me help you."
With Joseph's help, Arsinoe tears the last of Mirabella's skirt loose from the arrow to hang ragged at her knees.
"I've never seen you look so awful," Arsinoe says, and Mirabella laughs. "And you're so tall." "But you always were the tallest."
Mirabella's eyes soften as Arsinoe's words sink in. She knows that Arsinoe remembers her.
"That is because I am the oldest," Mirabella says and lifts her chin. "By less than 5 minutes, to hear Willa tell it."
Jules whistles from the center of the ring. She motions with her head toward Katarine, then again to the crowd. There is no quick escape. Camden's ears flicker back and forth, betraying Jules's fear. Joseph steps up beside Arsinoe.
"Well," he asks, "what's the plan now?"
"You knew what the plan was," she says out of the side of her mouth. "The plan didn't work. Why do you think we had to run out here?"
Fantastic,
Joseph sighs.
Guards!
Genevieve Aaron yells from the gallery, leaning so far over the railing that it looks like she might fall over it. Even from the distance of half the arena, Arsinoe can see how white her knuckles are.
Take the fugitive queen and the naturalists to the cells!
Arsinoe, Jules, Joseph, and Mirabella form a tight circle as the Volroy guards flood into the arena. Even with Jules and Camden, they cannot fight their way out. And they cannot run, except perhaps to go up and over the stands, and Mirabella could never manage it, still so weak.
Arsinoe, Mirabella says, you could have gotten away. You should not have tried to save me.
I don't think there was ever any saving us, Arsinoe replies grimly. I just didn't want to be what they thought I was.
Stop!
Catarine waves her arms at the guards and the council.
This is not over. I can still kill them. I can kill them both if you will remove that.
She points at Jules and sputters with rage.
That cursed naturalist girl!
Don't you touch her!
Joseph and Arsinoe bark together.
This is over!
Arsinoe shouts up to the gallery.
She can't kill me, no matter what she thinks, and I refuse to kill anyone.
Nor will I,
adds Mirabella, and the High Priestess, on her feet beside Natalia Aaron, closes her eyes. Luca inclines her head as Natalia murmurs to her and nods. Then Natalia whispers to the council. At once, guards and priestesses run into the arena, separating Arsinoe and Mirabella from Catarine. Jules punches the first in the eye and knocks back another three.
Don't fight, Arsinoe says. It's over, Jules, but I will find a way to get you out of this.
What about you?
Jules asks, as the guards place nervous hands on her. She glares at them and jerks back and forth, not hard enough to free herself, but hard enough that they know she could.
Arsinoe, what about you?
Arsinoe stares after her, as Jules is taken away with Joseph and Camden. But she has no answer. The Volroy. The guards take them to the Volroy, as Arsinoe expected. But instead of hauling them into the council chamber to be thrown at the feet of Natalia Aaron and High Priestess Luca, they are brought quickly and quietly underground and put into the cells deep beneath the castle.
You can't leave us here, Arsinoe argues as the door closes. We would speak to the council. Mirabella, call for priestesses.
She turns, but Mirabella lowers herself quietly onto one of the wooden benches. They have locked them up together, at least, and in one of the nicer cells, with four walls and a door with a barred window, and plenty of straw on the floor. Shouts and scuffling ring out in the corridor, and Arsinoe looks and sees Jules and Joseph being dragged past. Jules slams her escort hard against the stones when Camden yowls. They have the poor cougar choked between two long poles, attached to ropes around her neck.
Let the cat go, Arsinoe says, and you'll have an easier time of it.
They frown, but release their poles. Arsinoe's throat burns with anger, watching poor Camden scramble fearfully behind Jules's legs.
It'll be all right, Jules, she calls. Joseph, take care. We won't be down here long.
There is no reply, just the sound of their scraping shoes growing fainter and fainter. We are a curse on the ones we love, Mirabella says.
Yes, but what were we supposed to do? Die like we were told?
Arsinoe turns away from the door and sits down on the bench beside her sister.
How do you feel?
Poisoned? But I suppose you know what that is like.
Actually, Arsinoe starts, but stops when she hears Billy's voice.
Let me pass, he barks. She's my betrothed. I will see her.
Is he talking about you? Asks Arsinoe.
Mirabella chuckles. No, you fool. Of course not.
Arsinoe rushes to the cell door and slaps her palms against the wood, her face to the bars.
"Stand aside," she orders the guards, and is surprised when they do. It seems that in the Volroy, queens are queens, even fugitive ones.
"Arsinoe!"
Billy runs to her. His fingers twist around the bars and he shakes the door. He kicks at it.
"Damn these bars!"
"Never mind them." Arsinoe puts her hands over his, and he stares at them, like he cannot believe the touch is real.
"You're alive,"
he whispers, his smile a flash in the shadowy hall.
"I should wring your neck."
"Good luck reaching far enough in here to do it," she says, and he laughs. "I'm sorry. I wanted to find a way to tell you, but I didn't know how."
"It doesn't matter."
He slides his hand through to touch her face. "I think I've gotten us into a mess."
"As usual. But we'll get out of it. Everything will be all right, now that you're alive."
"I'm still sorry that you thought I wasn't."
"I'm sorry I agreed to marry your sister,"
he says, and nods to Mirabella over Arsinoe's shoulder.
"How are you, Mira? Holding steady?"
"Just fine," Mirabella says, and Arsinoe blushes. All her words to Billy have been overheard. But what does it matter? She cannot hold back, and Mirabella is apparently thrilled, leaning toward them with her knees tucked up like a child hearing a bedtime story. "Billy," Arsinoe whispers, her voice so low that even he can hardly hear. "Jules's Aunt Kara and Madrigal are in the city. Look for them at the stables across from the Highburn, or in the southern forest by the riverbank. They'll be waiting for us with Braddock. Get word to Kate and Ellis. They have to come help Jules and Joseph if nothing else."
"I will," he promises.
He hurries away, and Arsinoe wants to scream. She grabs the bars, teeth clenched, so she cannot beg him to stay. But Billy stops and comes back.
"I love you," he says suddenly. "I should have told you. Maybe I never knew, but I do. And you love me too. Say it."
For a moment, Arsinoe just blinks. Then she laughs. "Mainlander? You can't make me say it."
"Then say it when I get you out of here. Promise."
"I promise." Her eyes flicker toward the ceiling. "What's happening up there, in the council chamber?" Billy's eyes flicker toward the ceiling as well.
"No news yet. Maybe that's a good thing."
He lingers.
"I don't want to leave you here. Neither of you."
"I know, but you have to, for now. Find out what you can about Jules and Joseph," Arsinoe says. "Don't leave them without help."
"I won't."
He slips his fingers through the bars to touch her cheek again.
"You will be out before the end of the day."
Natalia stands carefully still in the council chamber, waiting for the High Priestess to arrive. Carefully still, so as not to resemble a confused and stupid bird, like Sarah Westwood. "Queen Mirabella should be placed in a secured room in the East Tower," Sarah says. Her voice is shrill, and it is not the first time she has suggested the move. "She does not belong in the cells."
"The queens are safe and well guarded," Lucian Marlowe replies. "The sooner we sit down calmly, the sooner a resolution may be made."
He looks to Natalia for help, and she stares him down. What a fool, to try to reason with a Westwood. He ought to grab Sarah and shove her through the door.
And where is Luca?
High Priestess Luca, who takes forever to get anywhere, and uses her old legs as an excuse, but everyone knows she is fast and smooth as a snake when she wishes to be. It seems another age passes before they hear the swishing of Luca's robes, and she arrives flanked by the red-headed giantess. "Finally," Genevieve whispers as she ushers the priestesses into the chamber. "All are here, and the queens in their cells." She somehow manages to sound as if they had gotten their way, as if any of this has gone their way.
Natalia is the last to be seated, and she does so with grace, though everyone in this room she would gleefully throw out a window.
"This is unthinkable," Antonin says, staring down at his hands. "So many in the arena heard their words today, as if there were not enough whispers about these queens already."
"Whispers?" Margaret Boleyn interjects. "The whispers have risen to a roar, and long before this, the whispers started over little undead Catherine. They are not proper queens, the people say. There is something wrong with them."
"Do not speak this way about the queens," Sarah Westwood hisses. "They are sacred."
"Enough words." Cousin Lucian rubs his temples with long fingers. "The only thing that matters is what we do, and whatever is done must be done publicly. Catherine must execute them herself, with no interference seen from us."
"Executed? That has not been decided. Queen Mirabella has committed no crime. She was not part of this naturalist stunt."
"It does not matter," snarls Genevieve. "You heard her. She refuses to kill Arsinoe. And a queen who refuses to kill has committed treason."
"Against who?"
"Against the island."
Sarah looks to the High Priestess for help. But Luca looks only at Natalia, and Natalia back at her, as if they are the only ones who matter. Because they are.
"I would speak to the High Priestess alone," Natalia says.
Apprehension flutters through the council. It passes back and forth between her relatives in furtive glances until Genevieve is forced to speak.
"Sister, this decision is for us all."
"Indeed. And after Luca and I have finished talking, you will all agree with what we decide. Now go."
Genevieve closes her mouth. She moves herself away from the table and voices her displeasure by loudly ruffling her skirt. She leaves, and the others follow her out.
"Council members," Luca says before they close the doors, "do remember to quiet your voices in the halls. The guards and servants still have ears."
Renata Hargrove scowls, and the heavy black doors thump shut.
"How is it possible that Genevieve and I share the same blood?" Natalia asks and sighs heavily. "Shall I call for tea?"
"No, but I would not mind a glass of that."
Luca peers over Natalia's shoulder into the corner of the room, where there is a small stock of liquor.
"Unless it is all poisoned."
Natalia walks to it and pours two glasses.
"Not with Renata and Margaret on the council." She hands a glass to Luca,
and they sit together at the long, oiled wood table of the chamber. Side by side, they look at the relief sculpture that wraps around the room in black and white marble, scenes depicting all of the island's gifts, joined together as one.
"You know that crowning Mirabella has become impossible," Natalia says quietly.
"Not impossible," Luca says,
but her eyes fall to her glass.
"We will give them until Beltane, as is their right. And if they still will not, then we will put them in the tower."
Natalia drains her drink. When she returns from refilling it, she brings back the decanter.
"You know that will not be allowed. Not when there is one willing queen."
"Yes," says Luca. "Your undead girl. How happy you must be."
The old woman's eyes bore into her. What steel there is in this High Priestess. But not even steel can guard against the love for a queen.
"I know you do not want Mirabella to die. I know she is more to you than the temple's ambition."
Natalia sets her glass down and stares into it.
"We both know to what lengths we have gone to ensure that Catherine and Mirabella survived."
"All of our plans," Luca whispers. "All of our preparations, all failed."
"These queens are uncontrollable, unpredictable. They have taken the choice out of our hands, perhaps without even knowing they were doing it."
She watches Luca drink. The High Priestess knows all this.
She is no fool. That is not the way that I would have Catherine take the crown.
Luca's response is quick.
But you do mean for her to take it.
Genevieve was right when she called their actions treason, says Natalia. And Antonin was right when he said the people will doubt us, no matter the outcome. So I would have your voice again in this chamber, and someone of your choosing placed on Catherine's new council. If the crown is to weather this storm, it will need the backing of the temple.
You are bribing me, Luca says. For Mirabella's life.
Not a bribe. Never a bribe. None of us has won here, Luca. If we do not come together, we will lose what is left.
She sits very still and lets Luca study her. Lets her try to discern whether she is honest or plotting.
In the end, the High Priestess will accept. Natalia only extended the offer as a courtesy anyway.
Mirabella will die, whether Luca agrees to benefit from it or not.
Finally, Luca nods.
We should not let Arsinoe's execution be in front of the people, she says. She has caused too much trouble already. Who knows what else she might try if given the chance?
I agree, says Natalia. Though I also agree with the council that Catherine must execute at least one of them in the square.
Luca's face goes slack, thinking of how it will be to preside over Mirabella's execution.
The people were robbed of a duel, Natalia presses, and what they saw instead was not the image we would leave them with.
It will not be easy for Sarah and the Westwoods to accept this.
I know, Natalia replies. But you can convince them.
Natalia pours into Luca's cup and pushes it toward her.
Luca takes up the cup and drains it. When she sets it down, her hand shakes.
3 seats on the council, she says. 3 seats of my choosing.
Done. Natalia strikes her hand against the tabletop.
Poor old Luca. Her eyes wobble with doubt, as though that was too easy, as though she should have asked for more in exchange for her queen.
Order the executions, the High Priestess murmurs. And in the morning Catherine shall be crowned. I will do it myself.
Natalia exhales. It could have gone worse. The infighting, the roundtable discussions dragging into the night. Sarah Westwood wailing.
It is a relief, she says, gentler now, to have a High Priestess of your fortitude.
Oh, Luca replies. Natalia, do shut up.
Indrid Down. Madrigal and Jules's Aunt Kara were not at the stables opposite the Highburn Hotel. He should have known that they would not be, after passing Braddock's empty cage in the Volroy courtyard. But Billy started his search there anyway, hoping, knowing how much harder it would be to find them in the woods.
The southern woods, Arsinoe said, by the riverbank. He asks a nut vendor which way to go and makes his way there, alternately creeping through the trees, and then being noisy so they might find him instead. He wanders for most of the afternoon, until he is sweaty and tired.
I can't stay out here in the dark, he says to himself, and punches his way through a shrub.
Braddock greets him by standing up on his hind legs, and Billy screams.
Shush, shush, Madrigal hisses. She slaps his shoulder as his heart pounds, and the bear lowers to sniff at his pockets.
What's the matter with you? And what's taken so long? Where is Jules?
I couldn't get in to see Jules, he says quickly. I have a message from Arsinoe.
He tells them of the duel, and the queen's locked in the Volroy cells. Their faces fill with terror.
I don't know what's happened with Jules and Joseph after they were locked away, he says. But I think they're safe, for now.
Madrigal begins to pace, They will never let her go. They will never let my Jules go, now that they have her. Now that they know about her Legion curse. They'll put her